All right, guys, you are locked on Falcons. I am your host, Aaron Freeman. Today, I am talking about the Falcons signing of four of their six draft picks, as well as the current state of their fullback position.
You are locked on Falcons, your daily podcast on the Atlanta Falcons, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
All right, guys, you know me. I'm Aaron Freeman, founder of FalcFans.com, one of the longest-running Falcon websites on the internet, the host of this podcast, and you can also find me on Twitter at FalcFans. So today's episode, we're going to talk about the – briefly, we're going to touch upon the Falcons signing four of their six draft picks. Not a whole lot needs to be said about that, but we will talk about it because it's news, and we need to glom on to any scrap, any morsel of information involving the Atlanta Falcons at this point in time in the year. But the bulk of our conversation today will be talking about the Falcons' situation, their plans, whatever the scenario, whatever you want to call it, at the fullback position in light of the team losing, if you can use that term. I know some of you might use the term celebrating the departure of incumbent fullback Derek Coleman, a free agent who signed with the Arizona Cardinals today on Wednesday as I am recording this episode. So we'll talk about that a little bit later and get my takes. You got to get these takes off. So I don't know what's going on with the Falcons fullback position. Just spoiler alert, that's what we're going to be talking about. And I know there is a tendency of me to glom on to negativity in light of all the positives surrounding the team. But I am just... honestly, just sort of baffled by what the plan is, the quote-unquote plan is at the fullback position. But I'll save that towards the end. Let's talk about the Falcons' rookie class, the most of it being signed. They signed Isaiah Oliver, Ito Smith, Russell Gage, Foye Olakun leaving, top pick Calvin Ridley, as well as third-round pick Deidre Sinnott, unsigned as of this recording. Maybe those guys sign as you guys are listening to this on Thursday or at some point Friday when those rookies are supposed to report to Flowery Branch along with several of the undrafted free agents and many of their tryout players who are, I don't know how many players are going to bring them, but most teams bring in 20, 30-ish guys. So you have this massive pool of players of 40, 50, 60 players at these mini camps trying to impress the team to make a roster. And typically under Dan Quinn, if not every year, most years the Falcons have wound up adding players from this rookie minicamp to their roster between, you know, now and say, I think, mandatory, whenever mandatory minicamps happen, sometime in June or whatever the case may be. So stuff does happen at this minicamp. In terms of having guys that haven't signed their contracts, you know, typically I think the Falcons and most NFL teams like to have their guys signed at these minicamps. But if not, they are protected by some sort of liability and waivers that they can sign and whatnot in the event of an injury, which you hope doesn't happen, but can happen and has happened. So, you know, that's really all you need to say about the Falcons signing their rookie draft class. It's like Ridley and Deidre Sinnott will get signed. Holdouts are no longer an issue. Like they can, you know, these guys signing can take some time if you're like a top 10 pick, because there's, you know, elements of the rookie contract of these, since the CBA got signed, they have these sort of slotted contracts. So you already know what you're going to make. It's more like when you have these holdouts, when you have these guys that aren't necessarily, you know, we're getting into June, late June and July that haven't signed their contracts. Typically they're going to be upper level first round picks and the holdup is going to be sort of offset language, which to be honest with you, I don't quite fully understand, but it has something to do with the fact that if the team cuts the guy early or something, that they don't have to pay this amount of money, they don't owe the guy this much, and obviously players want side on one side of that, players and agents side, like, give me all my money, and the team's like, no, we want to minimize the money, and that sort of brings about disputes among teams, because like some teams are basically like for example, I can't use a concrete example, but off the top of my head, I'm reminded like recently, like a quarterback was taken like eighth overall, and because he was the quote unquote franchise quarterback for that team, they had no issue, you know, signing the offsets or whatever the case may be. They basically give him all his money. But then the following year, when an eighth overall pick was like a defensive lineman or a linebacker or some other position player, the team that drafted him, instead of just basically slotting in the new, I think this might have been the situation with Joey Bosa a couple of years ago. That may be the situation I'm thinking of, where he was like the third overall pick from the Chargers, and I think the previous year's third overall pick was a quarterback, and so they gave him all his money. I mean, it might have been, was that Blake Bortles? I don't know. It could be confusing. I'm going all over the place. But basically, then his situation, because he was like, the guys last year's third overall pick got all his money. Give me all my money. And the Chargers were like, no, we're not going to give you all, you know. And so it became a whole thing. And so he wound up, you know, holding out till like week two or something like that. I don't know. It was crazy. I probably should do my research before coming on the podcast. But I explained all that to basically say, like, that's not going to happen with the Falcons. Like, there's like a 0.00000 negative two chance of that happening with Calvin Ridley. So don't really worry about it. But that's a thing that does happen from time to time in the NFL. And because it doesn't ever really involve the Falcons, I'm not necessarily as up on it as I probably should be. But that's the point. So Falcons have four other six rookies signed probably within 48 hours of this podcast going up. They'll have the other two. If not, then within 4 to 8 days, they'll probably have the other two signed. I think the latest they've ever had a guy not be signed under the Quinn regime was like maybe like the second week of June. I think that was like Desmond Southland. I can't remember the exact circumstances why he didn't get signed until then. But yeah, typically they all sort of come in one fell swoop, typically within like 3 to 4 days of the first guy signing. So basically you should expect Ridley and Deidre Sinnott to sign over at some point over the weekend, if not before. So that's basically what I'm saying. All right. So let's move on and talk about the fullback position and what's going on with Derek Coleman and what the Falcons' plan is. But of course, first I want to plug the Locked On NFL Draft podcast with Trevor Sikkema and John Ledyard, who are reviewing all the drafts from all 32 NFL teams, including the Falcons, on that podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. So, guys, let's talk about the fullback position, because it's interesting that Derek Coleman signed with the Cardinals today. Of course, part of me is overjoyed, and the other part of me is underwhelmed. And the Falcon fan in me is overjoyed. The Cardinal fan of me is underwhelmed, I guess. And maybe there's a little bit of mixed opinions on that. I don't know. I think what's interesting is, you know, I think the reason why this is news is because it now means the Falcons can't re-sign Derek Coleman in the event that they go through this rookie minicamp with the roughly, let's say, 3.5 fullbacks that they have currently on the roster that are undrafted rookies. Those guys being Daniel Marks from Stanford, Luke McNitt from Nebraska, Demario Richard, and converted running back from Arizona State, who was the backup to Kalen Ballage, or no, actually was a starter over Kalen Ballage there the last year, couple of years. And they also have an H-back from Boise State by the name of Jake Rowe that many people think can transition to the fullback position. So 3.5 fullbacks, with Rowe being the half. Richard is being listed as a fullback on their roster, even though he was a running back, but he's a quote-unquote big, power, slow running back. So his future at that position is limited. So they have 3.5 fullbacks on the roster, and at least one thought process, at least from myself and others I've heard express similar sentiments, was that if they didn't like what some of these guys did during the rookie minicamp this weekend, which begins on Friday and ends on Sunday, then there would be a possibility that they would bring back Derek Coleman because he's a known commodity. And even though he's in not necessarily a good commodity based off his performance last year and in previous years at that fullback position, you know, it makes more sense to go with a guy that you at least know can be a competent to good special teams player, a functional NFL starting fullback, because he's at least been that for a couple of years in the NFL in Seattle and Atlanta, rather than just, you know, rolling the dice with this undrafted rookie, especially if none of them really impress you during this rookie minicamp that merits you being like, oh, this is going to go well. And it's similar to sort of what the Falcons did last year in the sense that they brought guys like Derek Coleman and they signed an undrafted free agent in Tyler Renew. They brought in a street free agent in Soma Vinuku, who played under Sark at USC. Those guys were on the roster around this time. Then in June, they wound up cutting Vinuku in order to bring in Jack Lynn, the linebacker out of Minnesota, who was another one of these, I think, tryout guys that they had at that initial rookie minicamp. And so then it was basically Coleman and Renew competing for the job during the preseason. Coleman wound up winning the job. It's interesting because I went back and looked at Renew's Pro Football Focus grades, and he graded really well. And my recollection from watching the games was that he was pretty middling at best during the games. But so that was just interesting to me. But yeah, Coleman won the job and went out about having a pretty underwhelming season, as I'm sure regular listeners of this podcast are well aware of and are very familiar with, because I don't know if it was a weekly occurrence on the show, but certainly we didn't go more than maybe 2 or 3 weeks talking about the Falcons without talking about sort of the underwhelming play of the fullback position throughout the 2017 season. Certainly talking about question marks at that position throughout the 2017 offseason. And certainly this has been a topic of discussion that we've talked about on this podcast this offseason as well. Just probably not nearly as much, because I'm not as hurt by the Falcons' decision to let Patrick DeMarco a year later as I was initially. It took me an entire year to recover from it. I'm still not fully recovered from it. Someone jokingly said on Twitter to me the other day that I should do a podcast devoted entirely to Patrick DeMarco and just move on and get over it as a way to getting closure. And my response was like, no, I'm not going to do that, because I'm not going to get closure from it, especially if the Falcons continue to have underwhelming fullback play. When you watch the film and you're just watching your fullback struggle, like, how are you supposed to get over the fact that you had the best fullback or the second best fullback in the league or the third best fullback, whatever you want to rank him? You know, let's get into these fullback debates like we get into these wide receiver debates that everybody, you know, like, oh, Julio's best. Hey, Antonio Brown's best. Let's do it. Let's get a Houschek. Let's get a Anthony Sherman. Let's get a Patrick DeMarco thing going. Let's do it, guys. I'm all for those fights on Twitter. But you had the best fullback in the league for 2 years, arguably the best fullback in the league for 2 years, and then you went to literally the worst fullback in the league last year, at least if you're looking at the Pro Football Focus grades, and Derek Coleman, and I'm supposed to get over it? Like, how? Like, you know, that's like going from Julio Jones to, I don't know, like, I can't even, like, Darius Hayward Bay or something, like, you know, like, oh, okay, like, oh, I'll get over it. Like, you let Julio Jones go. Like, how am I supposed to do that? So, just giving you a prelude to what's going to happen this season if this issue continues. And that's what we're going to talk about in a little bit. And it's like one of those things where, I don't know, it just seems weird to me that everybody seems to be a lot more optimistic about the fullback position at this time of year. I know, you know, that's the thing about the offseason. That's one of the reasons why I'm so bitter and butthurt about the offseason and positivity and all that type of stuff. But it's like people just get overly hopeful for stuff that doesn't really make any sense, at least from my perspective, to get hopeful about. Like, why are you hopeful about these 3.5 undrafted rookies, two of which were just kind of middling fullbacks in college that weren't at all draftable? Like, I know everybody's like jumping on the Daniel Marks bandwagon. And of the guys I've seen, I would probably say Marks is probably the best out of them, but like he had no shot at getting drafted. Like he was not anywhere on anybody's radar as a draft pick. You know, like he's okay. Like he can move well. He's not very powerful. Like I would really want to see him meet Luke Kuechly in a hole. Like I think that's going to go well for Daniel Marks. Like come on, man. Like you know, I don't know. No offense to Daniel Marks and his family or anybody. And here's what I'll say. There's always a couple of surprises in training camp. There's always a guy that I look at this time of year, like, oh, that's a camp body. And then he comes into training camp in the preseason, plays really well. And I'm like, oh, this guy's actually making a strong push to make the Falcons roster. And this guy is a surprise to me. There's always one or two of those guys every single summer. So maybe it's at this fullback position. I will wholeheartedly, you know, admit that that's a possibility. I don't think it's a very strong possibility, but it's a possibility. And now, you know, again, what I'll say is most of the guys, I won't even give caveats. So let's just say it's a possibility out there. I don't know, man. It's just, I look at the situation and I don't feel why anybody is confident that the Falcons have upgraded their fullback position. And I think this is a similar phenomenon to, I'm sure if I talk to Browns fans on a regular basis, or if I was doing Locked On Browns podcast, you know, the argument that would be made about the Browns quarterback situation going into 2018 is, well, it can't get any worse than it was last year with Deshaun Kizer and the team finishing 0-16. And I think, you know, to a certain sort of base logic, it's understandable that when you have, from a production standpoint, the worst quarterback in the NFL and your team did not win any games, from that standpoint, yeah, you can't get any worse. You can't have a worse record than 0-16. But here's the thing. Like, even though Deshaun Kizer was the worst quarterback in the league last season, he wasn't close to the worst quarterback ever, you know, or certainly not the worst quarterback to play in the last 2 years, because Jared Goff statistically was much worse the previous year than what Kizer was last season. And you look at that metric that I like to use, particularly when it comes to comparing quarterbacks historically, because unlike passer rating, it doesn't necessarily fluctuate based off of era. And that is ANYA, a.k.a. adjusted net yards per attempt, which, you know, factors in sack yardage and interceptions and touchdowns and all that sort of thing. If you go look it up, Google it, it works. And for the sake of what we're talking about here, I'm going to use it as the sort of the end-all be-all of sort of judging quarterbacks. And typically looking at their season, and I think it's a good method of doing so. Now, the interesting thing, as a side note, Jared Goff led the league in ANYA last year. So, you know, he was the worst in the league, and then he was the best in the league. So it's always interesting, those types of things. But it's interesting side note. But when you go back and you look at Deshaun Kizer's ANYA from 2017, and then you go back the last 15 years and look at the quarterbacks at least that have attempted 180 passes in the season, he's only had the 25th. Deshaun Kizer's 2017 season was only the 25th worst season of any quarterback in that span, going back to 2003, last 15 years. So you look at it, there have been 24 quarterbacks that have been essentially worse than Deshaun Kizer. So if you're a Browns fan and you're saying, well, it can't get any worse. Yeah, record-wise, it can't get any worse. But in terms of quarterback play, yeah, you can get worse quarterback play than what you got out of Deshaun Kizer last year. And so if you were able to then do that by drafting a quarterback, a specific quarterback that may or may not have played in the state of Wyoming this past year, you know, you could have realistically got worse quarterback play and been and had another 0-16 season on your hands because you downgraded from the worst player in the league at his position. Now, you know, I don't think Baker Mayfield's going to fall into that trap, but the point I'm trying to make is I think there's been this sort of push by a lot of people that, oh, Derek Coleman was so bad that year that the Falcons can't possibly get worse. And I'm like, do you guys not know how the NFL works? Like, you know, you can be absolutely the worst NFL football player, but you can still get worse than that. Like, you do realize that the NFL is the pinnacle of American football in the entire world. And so the worst NFL player is still probably better than 92% of the guys playing in Canada, 98% of the guys playing in the Arena Football League, you know, 99% of the guys playing semi-professional football, you know, 97% of the guys playing college football, 99%, you know. So it's one of those things where, like, you can just pluck anybody out from these lesser leagues or whatever, or somebody who's not good enough to make a roster, plug him in, and you can actually make a downgrade. So I think that's how I sort of feel like the Falcons' plan has been at the fullback position. And it's caused a lot of frustration with me these last couple of months. We'll see how it plays out. I'm not going to sit here and be like, this is definitely going to fail. But it does seem like it's perplexing to me. And we'll talk about this a little bit later. But I also want to plug LockedOnSports.com, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, bringing you all the latest on the NBA, NFL, and MLB sides of the Locked On Podcast Network. Again, that's LockedOnSports.com. So, you know, I look at it like this with the Falcons fullback position, and I don't get what the plan is. It just feels like the team consistently is just like, we don't care about the fullback position, but when you get to the actual season, it's like you kind of do care about the fullback position. Like you, it's interesting when you look at the numbers. Like you can look at the numbers and say, oh, the Falcons used the fullback only this much, X amount of time, and so it was a downgrade overall last year. Yeah, it's true. But it's interesting that when you sort of remove, like if you just look at first and 10 situations in the first three quarters where the game is within 7 points, either you're up 7 points or down 7 points or within one score, and you're not inside your own 20 or inside the opponent team's 20 in the red zone. And so basically the point is these are the situations where it sort of rules out game situation where or down in distance that sort of pushes you to call a certain type of play or use a certain type of personnel grouping. And again, this is a relatively small sample of the Falcons' entire season because it only represents about 20% of their entire offensive plays. But this is sort of like, I think this is sort of what's useful about looking at that group of plays, because it's like this is the time when the offensive coordinator has the most freedom because he's not constrained by down and distance. He's not constrained by field position or any of those things or being behind or being up, where he's going to have to call the game a certain way based off of those situations. So he has the most flexibility. And you look at those situations, again, it's only 20% of the entire Falcons playbook. But in those situations, and you look at the personnel groupings that the Falcons used, it's almost an exact three-way split between 11 personnel, 12 personnel, and 21 personnel. I think, you know, I can't remember the exact numbers off the top of my head because I remember it counted for about 90% of the Falcons play calling, but I think it was like something like 32, 31, and 27. Does that add up to about 89, 90%? If it does, then that seems about right. So yeah, it was like 32% 11, 31% 12, and like 28% or 27% 21, which is 11 is three wide receiver sets, 12 is two tight end sets, and 21 is fullback. Your sort of traditional classic 1975 NFL offense. That was an interesting discovery to me as I was sort of looking at Sharp Football Stats and their metrics and whatnot, and sort of basically saying that when Sark sort of has the freedom to call the offense how he wants to call it, there is no sort of strong distinction between, you know, those three personnel groupings, which make up, you know, 90% of those situations. And so it's one of those things where it's like, when he has that flexibility, the idea that like they have scrapped the fullback position from their offense because, you know, overall they called less, you know, situations that involved the fullback, less 21 personnel overall last year. It's like, I think that's more due to the situations prompting the Falcons to call their offense that way because they were behind in a lot more games last season than they were the previous year, certainly. And because, you know, other situations, you know, some of their red zone issues and whatnot were due to that. So I don't think the Falcons have really sort of abandoned the fullback position, at least in the way that when looking at their roster moves and trying to understand, read between the lines and trying to figure out like what's going on in those meeting rooms when they're making these personnel decisions and making these plans, it doesn't necessarily, like, it seems like they don't care about the fullback position, but when push comes to shove, when the actual execution of the offense, it seems like they still kind of do care about the fullback position. So it's just so baffling. And we talked about why the decision to basically let Patrick DeMarco walk for really nothing. You know, you let him walk when you had like, you know, what, $20 million in cap space, and you let him go for $2 million. It didn't make any sense. We talked about that ad nauseum last offseason. The argument then was, oh, it's because they're going to involve more of their offense in this three personnel, this three wide receiver set, this 11 personnel that we saw them use utilize more down the stretch with Taylor Gabriel. And the idea at the time was that at least the only logic I could come to was, you know, in order to feature Taylor Gabriel more in the offense, that would lead most likely to Patrick DeMarco being featured less in the offense. And in their frame of mind, if we're paying, you know, this, you know, so that was the thought process. That was the argument I made last offseason. And of course we saw that just basically not happen at all because they basically marginalized Taylor Gabriel from the offense entirely as well. So it was so baffling last year. And now looking at their plan and going with these 3.5 undrafted rookies, these untested rookies that aren't likely to succeed early in their career, it just seems like they're taking a big step back from my perspective. And it's so weird to me. And, you know, I know a lot of people are like, you know, you make this big deal about the fullback position. It doesn't matter. Like, they wouldn't have won any more games. You're absolutely, like, I'm not going to argue with you whether or not the Falcons would have won more games had they had Patrick DeMarco on the roster. Frankly, from my perspective, had they won more games last year, it would probably have been more detrimental to them, because I think when you look at it sort of using the ends to justify the means, if you were the Falcons last year, you wanted to either be the one, the two, or the six seed. And the only way you were going to be the two seed, it was basically by winning like four more games. And I'm not going to argue that Patrick DeMarco would have won the Falcons four more games last year. So winning one more game would have cost you the six seed, and the six seed was the path of least resistance to the Falcons going back to the Super Bowl, because you played the Rams. If you wanted to make the playoffs last year, the one team that you wanted to play last January was the Rams. They were by far the worst team in the playoffs, right? You know, the quote-unquote second-worst team in the playoffs was probably the Falcons. So, you know, I know people are going to disagree with that point, but I'm sitting here saying, like, when you look at sort of the situation, it's like, yeah, you wanted to play the Rams, and you wanted to play the Carson Wentzless Eagles rather than playing the Saints and the Vikings if you're the Falcons. So winning one more game, you know, everybody sat there and was like, oh, no, I can't believe we lost to Miami. And I'm like, it kind of worked out in the Falcons' favor that they lost to Miami. It didn't feel like it at the time, and certainly for like the 2 months after that point, it didn't feel like it, but it kind of worked out in their favor. So I'm not going to sit here to argue with people that, you know, Patrick DeMarco would have won more games for the Falcons. I'm kind of glad he didn't, or at least I would argue, hopefully he would not have won the Falcons four games. But the argument I would make is I think Patrick DeMarco's presence, particularly in the first half of the season, when Sark's was basically throwing stuff at the wall, trying to figure out what was going to stick, and the Falcons had identity issues through that first half of the season, Patrick DeMarco's presence, or at least a competent fullback's presence in the offense, would have stabilized the offense, because they would have not had to been just basically trying to figure stuff out and throwing stuff out. Do we use a fullback? Do we not use a fullback? Do we use play action? Do we not use play action? And so it would have stabilized the offense, laid a foundation like, this is our core identity, because this was what our identity was in 2016. We run the football, we pound the football, and we build off of play action off of that. And outside of the Green Bay game, outside of the Lions game, the Falcons really didn't do that at all through that Patriots game. It started doing a little bit more in the first game against Carolina, started doing it back again with the Jets, and we saw it sort of progress over the second half of the season. By that time, Sark sort of gotten his feet wet enough that he started to figure out other aspects of the offense that he wanted to, you know, using the 3x1 sets, the trips and whatnot, and sort of other elements of the offense that he started to figure out in the second half of the season. But I think having a fullback like a Patrick DeMarco would have stabilized that offense in the first half. Would it have won the Falcons more games? Who knows? Who cares? Frankly, that's basically what I was making the point earlier. Like, who cares if it had won the Falcons four games? But I certainly think it would have had a more positive effect on the Falcons offense. And I do wonder sort of if this plan, if we're just going to be right back in the situation where it's like, oh, this fullback, no, let's go, you know. And maybe the Falcons do intend to use a lot more three tight end sets now that Eric Saubert's got a year in the offense and should be a lot more capable of fulfilling in that role. But it's clear that if the Falcons were going to completely scrap the fullback position this year, why did they bring 3.5 fullbacks to minicamp? You know what I'm saying? Like, so it's weird. It's the one thing I just can't wrap my head around. I can't figure out what they're trying to do. It just kind of seems like all the other things that they do so well just like go out the door, and it just is baffling to me when it comes to this fullback position. So those are my thoughts on it. I still am struggling with it. Hopefully it works out for the Falcons again. As I said earlier, I hope that, you know, one of these guys emerges, or the Falcons wind up finding some successful player. If I was taking bets today, I would sit here and bet my money that the Falcons week one starting fullback is not currently on the roster. I thought there was a chance that it might be Derek Coleman if they brought him back. Clearly, that's probably not going to happen at this point in time, unless the Cardinals do cut him and the Falcons decide, you know what, let's give it another go. At least we'll get like a dozen special teams tackles out of it or something like that. So, you know, whether the Falcons make a move at the fullback position prior to training camp, during training camp, or right after training camp remains to be seen. But I just feel like we're going to get to week one, and we're going to have a different fullback than Daniel Marks, Jake Rowe, DeMario Richard, or Luke McNitt. So we'll see how that turns out. And I'm sure at some point in time, I hope to get Obi Mahaley on the podcast at some point in the future, and we can talk about this and, you know, be locked on fullbacks. Certainly I will, when I watch preseason games this summer, I certainly will be paying attention to third string fullbacks that are going to get cut, which is not a thing that most people would say, but only crazy people like me. So that's why you guys tune in to the Locked On Falcons podcast. And in the meantime, if you want to get your feedback, and you can do so on Twitter, I'm at FalcFans. If it's podcast related, just let me know. If it is podcast related, go ahead and send it over to Locked On Falcons SD Show's Twitter handle. Of course, you can email us at lockedonfalcons@mail.com. You can find us on Facebook at Locked On Falcons. Of course, you can leave a comment at lockedonfalcons.com as well as falcfans.com, where the podcast is posted daily. We will have a series of fan talks next week. Hopefully, if scheduling occurs, we'll have at least one fan talk next week. I will be contacting those people shortly to arrange those, and we'll probably have, I think probably two, but get people's thoughts on the draft and the offseason and what the plan is. Maybe we can have a little bit of fullback talk. And, of course, tomorrow you guys should be able to hear my scouting report of Isaiah Oliver as part of the series of rehashing the draft. And we'll get one of those scouting reports each week. We'll get Deidre and Sanat next week. And we'll have other people come on the podcast over the course of the summer to talk about these individual prospects as well. So look forward to that in addition to the scouting reports that I myself do. So that's the plan right now, guys. And until then,
you are Locked On Falcons, your daily Atlanta Falcons podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.